Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me back there? Thanks for all coming. Thank you so much for coming out on a Friday afternoon. We have a very special guest, AJ Jacobs. I'm Elliot Ratzman. I'm a visiting assistant professor in the religion department. And a number of years ago, I decided I was going to investigate a genre of literature which is known by a number of names, immersion journalism or stunt journalism, a sort of post-Gonzo, post-New Journalism, in which journalists experiment with practices. You are familiar, I'm sure, with some of the classic texts of journalists who try something out for a period of time in order to tell you something about it. For example, Black Like Me or Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed. A subset of this genre that dealt with the political concerns of the suffering other. In my course of reviewing this literature, I discovered an amazing author, A.J. Jacobs. And as I said in the flyer, A.J. is what you get when you combine Morgan Spurlock, Malcolm Gladwell, and Mark Twain. Because A.J. is certainly the funniest, cleverest, wisest of these experiments. I just want to show you a few of them to give you a sense of where the medium is going. So, for example, how to be perfect. Somebody investigates living all the laws of Leviticus for a year. Living Oprah, my one-year experiment, walking the walk with the queen of talk. A year without Made in China. A year of living black, just buying from black businesses. And there have been others, I'm sure the bookstores are littered with them. But AJ is sort of the original spur that resulted in this flood of very interesting writings. AJ's writings are the best of the bunch, and we're really honored to have him here today. AJ went to Brown. He was a philosophy major.
That's true. Right.
Otto, the bus driver from The Simpsons, also went to Brown. And from there, he entered the journalist world. He is a contributing Esquire, and as I recently found out, since few of us watch TV anymore, he is a consultant on the Dr. Oz show. So I'm going to turn it over to AJ. Please give him a big Swarthmore welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Elliot. It's great to be here, and I'm honored to be introduced by Elliot, who I've gotten to know a little bit, and who is brilliant, and who understands my project better than I do. So thank you for that. I'm going to have to ask you while I'm writing my next book to explain it to me. But this is interesting to see these other examples of, you know, doing something for a year. I actually often get asked to blurb, you know, someone says, I'm doing a year trying to learn the French horn. Will you write a little thing on the back of my book? And I usually do. Sometimes I don't. There was one book that came out about a year ago where the guy spent a year trying to make his penis longer. And I was like, I don't know if I can really get behind that one. Anyway.
It takes more than a minute.
I'll leave it there. But I thought I'll just talk for a little bit, and then Elliot is going to ask me some questions, and then you guys can ask me some questions. I'll just give you a very quick overview of what I've written. So for those who haven't read my stuff or did not listen to Elliot 2 minutes ago, I like to dive in and just immerse myself in my topics, like become a human guinea pig. I work at Esquire magazine. A few years ago, I wrote an article called My Outsourced Life. And for this one, I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to do everything for me. So they answered my phones for me. They answered my emails for me. They argued with my wife for me. It was fantastic. It was the best month of my life because I just got to sit back and watch TV and read books. Then, right after that, I did an article for Esquire on a movement called Radical Honesty. And this is a movement where they believe you should never lie. But then they go further than that, and they say whatever's on your brain should come out of your mouth, like no filter. So I tried that for a month, and that was the worst month of my life. That is just a horrible way to live. But interesting, nonetheless. I wrote this was actually my second book, was The Year of Living Biblically. And this was my attempt to dive into religion, immerse myself into religion. And this came about because I grew up with no religion at all. I grew up in New York City. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So not very. No offense to the Olive Garden, wonderful restaurant. But I wanted to learn about it, so I thought one way to learn about this would be to do it by living it, to learn it from the inside out, to follow in the footsteps of our forefathers and foremothers. And so I did. I bought a stack of Bibles, and I assembled a board of spiritual advisors. So I had rabbis and ministers and priests. And then I wrote down every rule that I could find in the Bible. And as you might know, this is a very long list. You know, hundreds of rules. Over 600 by many counts here. That's the stack of Bibles. So I wanted to follow all of them without picking and choosing, and to see how that affected my life. Which rules made my life better, which made my life more complicated. So I wanted to follow the famous ones, like the Ten Commandments right there. Love your neighbor, of course. Be fruitful and multiply. And by the way, I was fruitful. I had twin boys. So I take my projects very seriously, is my point. But I also wanted to follow the less famous rules, like, you know, the Bible says in Leviticus that you cannot shave the corners of your beard. I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow. And by the end, I had this huge topiary hanging from my chin. And I'll just give you a sense of that's the beginning, that's the middle, and there's the end. So as you might guess, I spent a lot of time at airport security with that. There's a side shot. The Bible says you cannot wear clothes made of mixed fibers. And this seems so strange to me. I was like, why would God care if I wore a polycotton blend? Seems like micromanaging on God's part. But I said there's no way for me to know if this has any meaning unless I try it. So I did. I got rid of all of my mixed fiber clothing. And weirdly, some of the rules that did seem the strangest at the beginning did take on meaning for me by the end. Not that one in particular, but many of the others. The Bible has a rule in Leviticus as well that says if two men are in a fight and the wife of one of those men grabs the private parts of the other man, then her hand shall be cut off. So I wanted to follow that one. That one I followed by default, by not getting in a fight with another man whose wife was standing nearby looking like she... So I was able to do some easily. But there were many more of these rules that were incredibly challenging. And they came in, the challenging types came in two parts. First, there were the parts that were just hard because they were about the everyday sins that we all commit. You know, the Bible says you cannot lie, you can't gossip, you cannot covet. And I live in New York and I work as a journalist. So that's 80% of my day I had to. And so I was faced with this question, how do I do a moral makeover? And one of the secrets I learned from this project was how important it is, how the exterior affects the interior, how much your behavior affects your thoughts, and the importance of even pretending to be a better person. And when you pretend to be a better person, eventually you become a better person. They say in business, fake it till you make it, and I really believe this is a powerful way to be and a powerful way to change, and it's the theme throughout all of my books. And they talk a lot about this in cognitive behavioral psychology, like that when you act in a certain way, then you become that way. So like, for instance, during this year, I would force myself to do things like visit a friend in the hospital, even though I really did not feel like it. But I would trick my mind. I would get into the hospital, I'd see I'm there, and I'd say, oh, I must be a compassionate person. And you become more compassionate. And it's even on the simplest things. You know, the studies show that if you force yourself to smile, it tricks your mind, and you become a little bit happier. So I really believe in the power of acting good, even if you don't feel it. And then the mind catches up. It's actually a very Jewish notion. There's a phrase in Judaism, deed before creed. So So you do the deeds, you follow the rules, you do the good stuff, and then the creed follows. But it was challenging. I'll tell you, one of the hardest for me was gossip. And luckily, I discovered that there's an Orthodox Jewish rabbis, a group of them in Brooklyn, who run a gossip hotline. So if you're, it's like a suicide hotline, but for gossip. So if you have the urge to gossip, you can call them up, and they'll talk you down from the ledge. So I did that. I spent some time on that. And I can give, I think I include the number in the book. So I recommend it. There's also the other type of rule that was very difficult to follow was, oh, thank you very much. It was so hard to reach down and press there. The other type of rule was rules that don't really jive with modern American customs. There were quite a few of these examples, but one of them that comes to mind is stoning adulterers. That was kind of hard to pull off, but I was able to stone one adulterer. I'll just very briefly tell you how it happened. It was later in the year, and I was really getting into the project, so I was wearing my robes and my sandals, and I had my beard, and this guy came up to me in Central Park, and he said, well, I'll give you a visual. That's sort of what I looked like, but without the sheep. The sheep was more for, like, the cover shoot. That was a rental sheep, but I did sometimes walk around looking like this, and a guy came up to me, and he said, why are you dressed like that? And I said, I'm following all the rules of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers. And he said, well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me? And I said, well, yeah, that'd be great. This is a wonderful opportunity. So I took out a handful of stones because I had been carrying around these stones hoping to run into an adulterer, or a self-proclaimed adulterer anyway. And he was very aggressive. He grabbed the stones out of my hands and threw them at my face. So I thought, thank you for the gasp. And so I thought, an eye for an eye, also in the scriptures, I could toss one back at him. So that's how I did that. Another type of rule in that genre was, if you take Leviticus very literally, you cannot touch women in their time of month. And if you take it very, very literally, you cannot sit on a seat where a menstruating woman has sat, because then the seat is impure and you become impure if you sit on it. And my wife found this offensive, so she sat in every seat in our apartment. And so I had to stand for most of the year, which I'll talk about my health book very briefly in a second, but that is, standing is actually very good for you. Sitting is terrible for your health. So she was doing me a favor, so I thank her for that. After the year ended, I did shave off my beard. I went back to wearing mixed fibers. But there's much that I have kept from that year, and I mentioned it briefly to Elliot's class that I was talking to earlier, and there are many things. I'll just give you two examples. One is the idea of gratitude, because the Bible says that you have to give thanks. So I was taking that literally and giving thanks for everything. So I would, even the smallest things, I'd press an elevator button, and I'd be thankful the elevator came. And then I'd get in the elevator, and I'd be thankful it didn't plummet to the basement and break my collarbone. And it was a weird way to live, but it was also wonderful because I got to realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we completely take for granted, and we focus on the three or four that go wrong. So it was a radical change in perspective that I really tried to keep. Another change is that I did at the end decide to join a synagogue. As I mentioned to the class, I don't really go, but no, we go sometimes, but not as much as we should. But I wanted to be a part of the community. I wanted to give my kids just a little sense of my heritage, just a taste of Judaism, so they could decide later whether they wanted to be observant or not. But I also like the idea of a community, because it's in biblical times there wasn't this sense of the individual. The smallest unit of society really was the family or the tribe, and we often see the world as a series of rights. We have the right to this, the right to that, but I think a more biblical point of view is that life is a series of responsibilities, that we have a responsibility to our family, to our neighbors, to the elderly. And I think that that is a wonderful way to look at the world. I think you need a mix. I think, you know, we want to have some individualism, but I think that we've gone too far in that direction. So I like bringing in some biblical perspective. After that year, I felt I had worked on my body. I'd worked on my spirit, so I decided I was going to work on my body. And that was the origin of my next book, which was Drop Dead Healthy. So I'll just briefly talk about that before Elliot comes in to grill me. And I needed to work on my body because I was in terrible shape. I wasn't traditionally fat, but I was sort of skinny fat, which is like when your body looks like a snake that swallowed a goat. So I felt I needed some work in that area. And I also got sick. I was in the hospital with pneumonia, and my wife said, I don't want to be a widow. You know, you've got to get in shape. So I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it the same way I did the Bible book and just go all in. And so I got a board of medical advisors, so doctors and trainers and nutritionists, and I wrote down every health rule that I could follow, that I could find. And again, this was hundreds of rules and pieces of advice, and it was overwhelming. So actually, in the beginning, I sort of went in very slowly. So I tried to rationalize all of my vices, because there are a lot of studies that say, for instance, coffee is good for you because it staves off Alzheimer's, and it prevents certain types of cancers. Lots of research that chocolate, really dark chocolate, good for you with the preventing heart disease. A lot of research that alcohol, in moderation, just one drink a day is good for you. That it's really good for preventing heart disease. A lot of research that heroin is good for you. That's not true. I don't recommend that at all. But I was for a while trying the alcohol, chocolate, and coffee diet. But I realized that has its limitations. So I went and I decided to dive in and try to follow all of the other health advice as much as I could. And that turned out to be like a 24/7 occupation, because there's so much to do. You know, you got to exercise, you've got to meditate. A lot of proven benefits to meditation. You've got to put on sunscreen. If you take the dermatologist at their word, they say to put on a shot glass full of sunscreen every 2 to 4 hours. That's like half your day is spent putting on sunscreen. You have to pet dogs, because there's a lot of research that dogs are very good for your health. They lower your blood pressure. I didn't have a dog, so I would go to the dog park near my house and pet other people's dogs, which was, you know, got a mixed reaction. But I was on a mission. You've got to make your own food, because as you know, processed food is pretty terrible for you. And then you've got to eat that food. And if you're eating in a properly healthy way, that takes a while, because our mothers were right. We do not chew our food. We're a nation of under-chewers. Chewing will give you more nutrition, and it'll also slow down your eating, which is very important. The slower you eat, the less you eat, and portion control is a very big part of being healthy. And I actually ran across this group on the internet who are like very pro-mastication, and they call their movement Chewtyism. So that's them, not me. I don't want to take credit. I'm not a big fan of the puns. But they say you got to chew your food 100 times per mouthful, which is insane, because then, you know, you're spending 2 days eating a sandwich. But they're generally right. We do need to chew our food. So that was just one little takeaway out of many. I tried, since, as Elliot mentioned, I'm an immersion journalist, so I tried to immerse myself in all of these different diets. I tried the raw food diet, the paleo diet. I tried all different workouts. I tried all different tests to see. Here's one, by the way, here's That's me hailing a cab during my biblical year. Very effective. But I tested my brain. I tested sleep. By the way, I did not get a great night's sleep that night. Still trying to figure out why. Then I did the stroller size workout where you push your kid around. You turn your kid into a piece of exercise equipment. The caveman workout where you crawl around in the forest and throw boulders and climb trees. And I tried all sorts of products. The strangest product, I don't have a picture, which you'll see why that's a good thing. But the strangest product was something called Nature's Platform. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. But it was one of the surprises of the year was I realized I had been going to the bathroom incorrectly for 40 years. That we go to the bathroom in an unhealthy way because we are not built to sit. We are built to squat. That's the way we are. So this is a platform you can order on the internet that will go over your toilet and you climb on top, and it basically turns your bathroom from a first world toilet into a developing world toilet. So I tried that, and I had it in the bathroom for about 2 days before my wife was like, get this out of here, this is disgusting. So that I don't do anymore, but if you really want to be optimally healthy, buy the Nature's Platform. At the end of the year, the same as with my biblical year, I can't keep everything from what I was doing, but I've kept a lot. And I'll just end with three or four examples of things that I've kept. One is that I've really tried to, as I mentioned before, not sit down as much. I feel a little guilty because you're all sitting down, but you'll get up soon. But the research on sitting really is quite alarming. It messes with your metabolism, your blood sugar, your weight, everything. So if you can just get up every 20 minutes and walk around for a couple of minutes, that makes a huge difference. I joined the whole treadmill desk movement where you have a treadmill and you put your computer on top of it. So I wrote the book while walking on my treadmill. It took me about 1,000 miles. Actually, here's one setup I had, which was not that successful because it was backwards. But I have a more professional one now. So walking as much as possible, and to get myself motivated to walk, I find that having a pedometer makes a huge difference. And this is all part of a movement called the quantified self. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. But the idea there is the more you measure yourself, the healthier you act. So something as simple as a pedometer, just having it and trying to get to the goal of 10,000 steps makes a big difference because it changes the way you think about moving. You know, before, if I lost my keys, I'd be all annoyed that I'm walking around my apartment looking for them. But now I'm like, this is great. I'm racking up the steps. And I found a website that I really recommend. I'm trying to promote it. It's called earnedit.com. And this is a website that you get points for walking. You sort of sync your pedometer with it. And you can either use those points to buy things or you can use them for charity. So I use them for charity. I get free water for Haiti, clean water. So if I'm not walking, I feel like I'm killing Haitian people. it's very motivating. So I really recommend that, earnedit.com. In terms of food, there are two things you got to remember, of course, which is quantity and quality. The quantity I talked a little about, you want to eat less. So Chudaism is one way to do it. There's other techniques, like you want to have smaller plates, you want to set up your house or apartment so that the good food is at eye level, because we are incredibly lazy, so we just take what's at eye level. And then in terms of the quality of food, I think that the secret is that it's not a big secret. I don't know if you guys have read Michael Pollan's books, but he's a food writer and And after all this research, he said it boils down to three things, which is, I can't remember the three things. Eat whole foods, eat real food, not too much, and mostly plants. Thank you. Which I think is right. I think that's the basic. The research out there does support a mostly plant-based diet. You have some people who disagree with that, you know, the low-carb folks, the paleo folks. But at this point, most of the science is on that side. So that's what I've settled on. And both sides, the low-carb side and the mostly plant side, they both agree on one thing, which is that white sugar and white flour, these processed carbs, these simple sugars, those are the worst. So if you can avoid those, you're like, you're halfway there. And finally, I learned that you shouldn't really stress too much about your health. I think that I was so obsessed with health that it was not good for me. I interviewed a doctor, in fact, who has come up with a new type of eating disorder called orthorexia, which is an unhealthy obsession with healthy food. Because if you're so obsessed with eating just the right food, then you can't go out with your friends. You're isolating yourself. And going out to dinner with friends is a huge part of health. Being part of a community, social connections, is as important as food, exercise, and sleep. So don't get too wound up about this stuff. Those are my two books that I wanted to talk about. I will end, since Elliot brought up this whole idea of immersion journalism, I'll end with a story that a rabbi told me right before I wrote this book, The Year of Living Biblically, and it kind of relates to this idea of immersion and action. And I was very nervous before I embarked on this because I was worried that people would misinterpret it, that I would be seen as flippant, and that I would get a lot of slack, and I was in over my head. But he said, let me tell you a story of it's not actually from the Bible. It's a story about biblical events, but it's from something called the Midrash, which are legends about the Bible. And he said that when when the Hebrews were fleeing the Egyptians, they got to the Red Sea, and Moses opened his arms and tried to part the Red Sea, but nothing happened. It just stayed flat. And the Hebrews were, understandably freaking out because the Egyptians were right behind them and were going to come and slay them. They didn't know what to do. So finally, one of the Hebrews, whose name was Nachshon, decided just to walk in. So he walked into the water and he waded up to, the water went up to his knees and then his waist, his stomach, his chest, his neck. And then right before it was going to get to his nostrils, the seas parted. And so the rabbi told me that the idea, the moral is, sometimes you just have to wade in. You have to dive in to make miracles happen. So that's been one of the guiding forces of my experiments. You just have to dive in sometimes and make things happen. So thank you for coming and listening to my little talk. And I'd be happy to answer, well, first Elliot's questions and then any questions you guys have.
Thank you. Just want to also mention, there is a Swarthmore connection. Professor Nathaniel Deutsch, who used to teach here, was one of the consultants on, what would you say is one of your spiritual advisors?
Totally. He was right on the board. Did any of you ever have him as a teacher, or was he before your time? No? He's a great guy.
A few things. One of your first immersion experiments was a book called The Know-It-All, which I totally recommend. It's hilarious. It's a book about reading the entire Encyclopedia Britannica, which is one of the requirements actually for getting into this college.
As well, it should be.
So could you maybe say a little bit about that book, how that was received? How did the pitch go to the publisher for that?
Well, I initially pitched that as an article to Esquire. Thank God they turned it down, because imagine spending a year and a half on an article. That's horrible. But uh, I uh, I got the idea because my dad started to read the encyclopedia when I was a kid, when I was in high school, but he didn't quite finish. He made it up to the middle of the letter B. So I thought I could try to remove that black mark from our family history and finish the encyclopedia. So that's what I did. And I wrote the book as, you know, in chapters, so chapter A, chapter B, and it was all about my, reading, what I learned, the strangest, most interesting things I learned, but also, like, how I joined Mensa, which I got in a little sideway. So I don't consider myself a genius, but I am a member of Mensa. There are some loopholes. I can tell you about them if you want. They basically just want your money, like every other organization, so you can get in. But anyway, I went on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So that's what the book is about. And it was great. I loved the experience. I learned a lot, strange stuff, but also uplifting stuff. And it was uplifting overall, because I do think it made me realize progress is real. Like, you know, we tend to glorify the good old days, but it's the good old days were not good.
Well, I sent around to my students several articles. Your Outsourced Life, which did you say it was optioned to be a TV show or?
That was optioned to be a movie. It never got made, but so the rights, I think, are back being available if you guys want to.
And I sent them around the Rationality Project as well. And was that when you were doing the Radical Honesty, or was you were
no,
trying
that
to?
That was a separate article, mm-hmm. But that was. Yeah, that was trying to eliminate all of the biases that these built-in biases we have. One of the most famous is that we're so afraid of car crashes. I mean, so afraid of airplane crashes, even though car crashes are much, much more common because we see on the news an airplane crash, and it makes this big impression. It's called the availability fallacy. So I try to live the perfectly rational life, to only be afraid of those things that I should be afraid of.
So you're afraid of driving?
Driving, absolutely. Terrified of it. And heart disease, that's it. Driving, heart disease, and cancer. Everything else is fine.
Well, why don't we open up some questions, and I'm sure people have some curiosities before we move along.
Yes.
So did you start in normal journalism? how did you make the transition? And speaking of pitches, so what did your pitch for Your Living Biblically look like? And how many people did you have to pitch it to before someone paid you to do that?
Well, I did start in normal journalism, and I still do some of it. I started at a tiny newspaper in California, circulation like 20,000, which does not exist anymore, of course. And I was writing about the tiniest things, like, you know, sewage meetings and taxes and PTA meetings, which I actually think was good because it gave me a real foundation in reporting, which I think is the basis of all good writing, is just research and details. But then one of my first experiments was when I was working at Entertainment Weekly. And I looked exactly like this B-list actor whose name was Noah Taylor. And he had actually been in a very acclaimed movie called Shine. And so they sent me to the Academy Awards to see what it would be like to be an actor at the Academy Awards. And it was awesome. I mean, it was like everyone loved me.
I'll pass around the picture.
So I signed autographs and my ego got huge, even though it wasn't exactly me they were complimenting. But still, all that positive feedback, it's hard not to be affected. But anyway, and then the pitch for the Year of Living Biblically, it was about 20 pages. I just wrote what I was going to do. And luckily, my first book about the know-it-all had done well enough that they trusted me. So I just pitched to the same publisher.
In your living biblical experiment, do you find any contradictions in the rules that are provided to you, either in practice or with your advisors, and so how did you resolve
it? Yeah, well, it is. There certainly are a lot. I mean, there's, as I said on The Simpsons, Ned Flanders says, But I'm obeying all the rules of the Bible, even the ones that contradict the other ones. So I thought that was a good theological statement. I mean, my feeling about the Bible is that it was written by many different people over thousands of years, and so there are going to be parts. I actually, at one point, and I don't mean disrespect because I love Wikipedia, but I compare it to Wikipedia because it is the same idea of there's not one editor. There's lots of different editors, lots of different writers. So you are going to get contradictions, and you know there's an eye for an eye and turn the other cheek is just the most simple. But part of the conclusion I had in my book was that you do have to pick and choose, and you can't follow everything. And there are fundamentalists who say this is a bad thing. They say, you know, that's cafeteria religion, which is a very derogatory phrase. You know, you're just picking and choosing parts of the Bible. But my argument is, what's wrong with cafeterias? I've had some delicious meals at cafeterias. I don't know what the Swarthmore cafeteria is like.
I like going there. I go there once in a while. Every day for these guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe it doesn't ring true to you guys. But to me, the idea is that, you know, there's wonderful parts to the Bible about compassion and loving your neighbor, but there's also, you know, incredibly sexist parts. There's homophobic parts. So I think it's okay to pick and choose. I think that's our responsibility. Yeah?
Could you comment a little bit about the future of the print books, magazines, and how's that affecting your work?
Well, yeah, it's a great question, and I wish I had the answer. And I think no one has the answer because things are so in flux and changing so fast that anyone who pretends to know what's going to be in 5 years is absolutely, you know, wrong. No one knows. I will say, creatively, I think it's one of the most exciting times for writing and for all arts, because the opportunities are so massive, and you can combine video and text, and you can also publish. You know, we're all publishers now. So creatively, it's awesome. Financially, not so much, because it is getting increasingly difficult to make a living as a creative person, because people expect free stuff. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there are still going to be brands that we go to. So, you know, I think that I don't know which ones they'll be, but, like, you know, the New York Times will exist in some form, and hopefully Esquire, where I work, will exist. But it will definitely be harder to make a living as a creative person.
Does Esquire actually exist in a physical space, or do you have an office, for example, or do they just meet by, you know, conference call?
Right. Well, no, as of today, they still have a physical space. So, I think in about 10 years they might not, but right now there's an office and the whole thing.
Some more hands up.
So are you planning to continue with immersion journalism? Are you in the midst of an immersion experience right now?
Well, I was just telling Elliot's class that I just finished one, which I immersed myself in a movement called life logging. And this is a movement where you record every part of your life. And I bought a tiny video camera that was like the size of a cigarette, and it was in my ear, and it recorded my entire day from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep. So, and the idea is, you know, our memories are terrible. 70% of my fights with my wife are, you know, that you never told me that. That's not what you said. So here I could be like, well, let's go to the videotape. Let's see what happened. Which turned out to be horrible, because it was like a lose-lose. Because, you know, if I was wrong, I lost. And then I was right, then she just got more angry. So, but I do believe that this, you know, this is the future. I do believe that we all eventually will be recording every moment, and it'll have its good parts and it'll have its terrible parts, but I do believe that that'll happen.
Where on the web is the stream of your life?
I didn't stream it, because you definitely don't want to see some of it. But it's all in my hard drive, and hopefully we'll never reach the cloud, but maybe it will. You do realize that 90% of your life is incredibly dull. So, but then there's that 10% that's pretty interesting. And to have these moments on tape with my kids, I love the fact that I've got these moments I normally wouldn't have. So, yeah.
Skyback thing.
Yeah. Where do you find the motivation to keep doing this throughout like a whole year? And has there been like any point where you've like come really close to giving up on a certain project?
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely always am tempted to quit. But I think part of it is that I have obsessive compulsive disorder, so I'm able to channel that into these projects, so that instead of washing my hands 400 times a day or whatever, I'm able to focus on doing something like this. And when I'm not doing it, I kind of feel antsy. It's a little disturbing. I feel like I'm unanchored when I don't have, like, so it's almost like a religion. We were talking earlier about how religion has these very set structures, and that it provides, one of the advantages, it provides a freedom from choice, which I think is a very appealing thing. So I like having these structures. So, but there are times I definitely want to quit, like reading the encyclopedia, No offense against Portuguese literature, but like 40 pages about Portuguese. After like 38, I was like, I think I've got enough Portuguese literature to last me a lifetime.
You had a piece last year in the, maybe it was over the summer, about your other compulsive habit, which is blurbing books.
That is true.
Right. So,
yes.
So you published a piece in the New York Times about your compulsive blurbing life.
Right.
Could you tell us some of your greatest hits?
Well, I definitely...
Books you regretted, for example.
Well, I mentioned the one where the guy tried to get a bigger penis for a year. That one I did not blurb, and I'm very proud. But most of the others I do blurb. And I get in a little trouble because I'm a little too free with my blurbs. I'm a promiscuous blurber. I blurb... There's a book sent to me by a guy who was going to live off the land for a year, so I gave the blurb. I said, buy this book, read it, then compost it. And I was so proud of myself. I was like, that's pretty good. And then I submitted it, and right before it came out, I looked back at my other list of blurbs, and I had used the exact same joke on another book about recycling. And so I was terrified someone was going to bust me. But I had a plan. If someone said, you're recycling, I said, well, I'm just trying to be environmental and recycle my jokes, a precious resource. So, but luckily no one ever busted me.
Okay, one here is, thou shalt read this book.
Yeah, that I recycled like 7 times.
and so one of the trends in immersion journalism is that people have sort of experimented with being differently religious. And your intern, Kevin Roos, wrote, I think, one of the best books. I can't believe he actually wrote that whole book when he was 24.
He was younger than that.
Was he?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's a
Brown junior. He takes a semester off to go to Liberty University. He was the last person to interview Jerry Falwell alive before he died. And it's an incredibly sensitive portrayal of evangelical culture.
Yeah.
And Gwen Kessler here uses it in her spiritual journeys.
Really?
Class. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm going to tell him. He'll be so excited. Yeah, the premise was he went from the most liberal university, Brown, to the most conservative, Liberty. But as Elliot said, I was so impressed because it was a very nuanced portrayal. It wasn't making fun of evangelical culture. But it was a fascinating book, and you got to see this, they don't, you're not supposed to have physical contact with the opposite sex, so they do something called gazing, where you look deep into the other person's eyes. That's sort of the equivalent of I feel, I just saw some gazing going on right now. I feel dirty watching it. Voyeur. But yeah, so it was a great book. And by the way, can we talk a little about your project? Because
let's talk a little bit about some of the things I might be writing about. So let me just warn you guys. There's also some really bad emergent journalism projects. Let me just say, who here has read Nickel and Dime by Barbara Ehrenreich? You know the premise. She lives a low-wage worker, as a low-wage worker for like 6 months in different areas. It came out in 2000. It was an assigned reading for the incoming freshman class of the University of North Carolina in 2004. Well, one of the dudes of that class decided he was going to reproduce the experiment. This like wealthy white guy was going to like see if he could make it on $25 living in South Carolina. So he wrote the most, what I call the douchebag's nickel and dime. It was like the most terribly offensive immersion journalism project, where he goes and decides he's going to live in a homeless shelter in Charleston, South Carolina, and take low wage work until he bought a car and made it. And it's really a terrible experiment. So there's no inevitable sensitizing to suffering through these projects. There was another one called My Year in Radical Islam, where he's a neocon pundit now, and he converted to Islam and lived in a moderately radical, not even very radical, community for a year. There's some really terrible ones. Among the Believers is a version of Kevin Roos's book. It's not very. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this live. But there are a number of very excellent, very sensitive immersion projects. But there are questions about the ethics of it, which is some of the things I'm writing about. Like, what are we to think about people that, say, put on blackface, like the congressman from Brooklyn? Was it Dove Hinken? Is he a state senator?
Yeah. I forget what he is, but he's
Orthodox Jewish state senator put on blackface for Purim last week and said, hey, what's the problem? He's wearing this really terrible wig and blackface on. And John Stewart points out that this is the guy who's been complaining about anti-Semitism for years, even when it's not there. So what are the ethics of when one can actually pretend to be, let's say, another color or another gender or another religion or another race? What can one, like, how? What are we supposed to think about this? And some of my research is how extreme the reactions are. Like, either somebody like Barbara Ehrenreich becomes incredibly admired and is seen as an authority, like I suppose you are sometimes seen as an authority on the Bible. But then people react terribly, like, who are they to do this? They could always always jump out of their identity.
Yeah.
So, and to bring this back to your life, there was a book that came out just a few months called The Cross in the Closet. Has anyone read this book, The Cross in the Closet? Have you heard about this book? Fascinating. A formerly conservative evangelical man in the South decides he's going to tell everybody he's gay for a year, and so come out to his friends, his family, his church, and see what their reaction is. And he works in a gay coffee house in a neighborhood in Nashville, and he crowdsourced the funding, the PR funding for it online, and did a sweep of the talk shows and the news programs. And it's actually a go-to book now for young evangelicals who are trying to come up with a language to talk about how they can be both Christian, evangelical, and either an ally or LGBT-friendly and part of the community. Now if you read the book, it's okay, but there are some ouchy moments. But it is about a straight person who has no idea about gay culture discovering what gay culture is like.
Right.
And also that there are more Christian gay men than he ever imagined. Hmm. We were more Christian than him, he said.
Interesting.
But I think he contacted you at some point.
Yes, he did. And he was one of the few I did not end up blurbing. I admire him, and I think it was a very interesting project. My only problem is, as a parent, he told his parents he was gay and put them through a lot of psychic pain, for the project. In the end, it might have been the moral thing to do, because he did make the community more tolerant and towards gay people, which I think is a totally great goal. But then there's this ethics question of did the end justify the means, you know?
Did anybody here see Dick Gregory at Bryn Mawr last night? Dick Gregory is a comedian and activist from the 60s, African-American writer, activist, and comedian. And one of his best friends was John Howard Griffin, who was the white Texan who lives as a black man for 6 months. Now, of course, maybe the difference between what you're doing and what, say, Griffin or Ehrenreich or even people like Jack London is that they pretended and went undercover as these identities. It doesn't seem that you're going undercover. Like, you're saying, hey,
true.
I'm
the
I'm
only time I went undercover was when I went undercover as an Academy Award-winning actor. But the rest of the time, I'm completely open about what I'm doing. Sometimes people are taken aback in the beginning because they don't know. You know, people, like, why are you dressed like that guy? But I try to be open, even about the radical honesty. As part of the radical honesty, I had to explain, I'm trying to be radically honest. So, but sometimes it didn't get to that. It was very, like, the worst part, the worst moment, I think, was when I was in a restaurant with my wife and some friends of hers from college came over and was like, oh, this is great. Great to see you after all these years. We should get together. And I had to say what was on my mind, which was that, you guys seem nice, but I really don't ever want to see you again, because I have all these friends I don't ever get to see. So they didn't appreciate that. My wife. So that was not a pleasant moment. And I was going to explain to them, you know, I'm sorry, I'm just being radically honest for this project, but they were long gone by that time.
Well, your wife is an excellent character in all your books. What does she think about the way that you portray her? Because she's portrayed as long-suffering, eye-rolling,
right,
mildly tolerant of what you're doing.
She does. She likes. I think she likes it. She protests, but and then she gets back at me, you know, with the sitting on the seats when she was menstruating. But she definitely has veto power. She puts the kibosh on things. Not in the book so much, but in which projects I choose. A lot of readers have suggested that I do one where I try to become the greatest lover in the world. Like, do all the positions in the Kama Sutra. And my wife is like, that sounds exhausting. No way that's happening. So that never happened. And I'm okay with that. I don't think, I don't have the back strength anymore for that stuff. So, She has veto power.
Well, maybe let's open up some more questions. People are curious about the writing process. Or as part of my project, I will be undergoing an immersion experiment. I'm taking suggestions, but I think right now I think I will live as a tall man with lots of hair. But other comments or questions?
Yeah.
Are you trying to make a social point in your work? It seems, without having read your books, that you are jesting at some social norms by taking it to the extreme. What? Is that part of what's going on?
That is part of what's going on. I mean, certainly for the Year of Living Biblically, I wanted to show, you know, there are millions of people who say they take the Bible literally, and that informs their views on homosexuality and creation. That the world is 5,000 years old. So I one of the motivations was, I said, well, what if you really do take the Bible completely literally? Because I got the sense they were taking parts of it literally, but not everything. So I took it to the extreme to sort of show that this approach to the Bible is a flawed one, that you don't have to take the Bible literally to take it seriously. You can you can see it as a metaphor, and you can see it as stories, and it can be very meaningful, but you don't have to take it literally. So yeah, I think that's one, you know, the taking the argument to the extreme to show it's absurd. I think reductio ad absurdum, I think, is the official word. So yeah, that's true. Yeah?
When you were doing the health book, how did you decide which health dicta to follow? Because like the Bible, there are often contradictory directives. You know, one study comes out and says, do this, and then a few years later, another study comes out and says, yeah, it was all BS. Don't do that. And so as a journalist, how did you evaluate which ones you would take seriously enough to try to live by, or did you decide to sort of wander over the map without too much regard to how validated they might have been?
Well, some I tried to do mostly evidence-based stuff, but then not all, because I wanted to do some of the really bizarre stuff, because I think that makes for good reading. So, like, you know, there's this movement called calorie restriction, where you only eat 70% of what normal people eat. You're on the verge of starvation, because there are some studies in animals that say if you do this, you'll live longer. So they believe they're going to live to like 150. My reaction, which I think is most people's reaction, is, yeah, you may live longer, but why would you want to? You know, it's hard. It's like, if you can't have a waffle, what's the point of living? But I went to their house, and the founders of this movement, and they served me dinner, which consisted of a blueberry for the appetizer and a walnut as the main course. I should clarify that we each got our own blueberry. We didn't have to share the blueberry. So it wasn't crazy. But anyway, so I did try to do some of the wax stuff, but then I tried to do mostly the evidence-based stuff. And one thing that I'll just mention very quickly is that if you, you know, it can be very frustrating because there are all these competing health claims, but really 90% of health advice is the same and is what 99% of scientists agree on, which is, you know, get a lot of sleep, exercise as much as possible, eat whole foods, and don't stress out. Like, and then the rest of it is all on the margins. It's all fights, you know, is turmeric good for you or is it not? Those are pretty minor. If you follow the really basic stuff, then you're 90% there. Yeah?
With the year of living biblically, I could see, you know, a reconstruction
I was surprised. I was very nervous going in, thinking I would offend people, but I've got very good. I had several of my advisors were Orthodox Jews, and I mean, partly it was the Lubavitchers. I don't know if you know, they're the Orthodox. They're the Hasidic Jews, but they're the ones who they see the secular Jews as sort of like, you know, they can bring him over. So if you show any interest at all in religion, they're like so excited. So they were just delighted to help me. You know, I think they were disappointed in the end when I didn't become a Hasidic Jew, but for a while they were very happy. I did actually think this would be a good marketing of publishing, is like three different endings. One where I would become a Hasidic Jew, another where I become an evangelical Christian, another become like a Richard Dawkins atheist, and then I could sell them in different parts of the country. And then I would really make a lot of money.
You wrote the introduction to Ed Dobson's book, The Year of Living Like Jesus, which is actually a really interesting book. I don't know if you guys know Ed Dobson. He started The Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell back in the 70s, and he moved to the left. I think he was one of the evangelicals working for Obama in 2008. And in the book, he also, you know, it's interesting what you remember of the book. I remember he tries to live like an Orthodox Jew for a year. So he hears the outfits. He goes to synagogue. He's never been to a synagogue before, and he writes how terrible the singing was, which is something that like if you've grown up in the Jewish world, you just take for granted. But it was a very interesting experiment where he was trying to live the Hebrew Bible, the laws of the Hebrew Bible, but in the way that the Orthodox Rabbinic Judaism understands them, not the way that you would just read them in the Bible. So it's very interesting nuance what he did. There was also a book that just came out over the summer, the year of biblical living, biblical womanhood, which was AJ's experiment from the perspective of a woman, which was much more difficult. I haven't read that one yet.
I haven't either. But well, what you say is interesting, because the way the Orthodox, there's the Bible and what it literally says, and then there's what Judaism follows, and they are very different, because it's called the written law, which is what the Bible says, and then the oral law, which is what the rabbis teach. And for instance, just to give you one example, in the Bible, there are very few food rules, and all it says is you can't eat shrimp and you can't eat pork, and you cannot boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. So I had to spend the year not boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk. I could have boiled it in its like aunt's milk or its grandmother's milk if I really needed to, but I didn't. But the rabbis have taken that one line, you shall not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk, and really interpreted it in a much broader way, which is why you're not allowed to eat milk and meat at the same meal. You can't have a cheeseburger. And there are all these elaborate rules about separating milk and meat, and it's all from that one thing about baby goat and its mother's milk.
And of course, the laws of the Sabbath. So one of the Ten Commandments that nobody here is probably following is to observe the Sabbath. And so the question is, how do you observe it? How do you remember it? How do you sanctify it? And so Rabbinic Judaism elaborates a very complex list of what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath based on an interpretation of parts of the Bible. But people find this is very strange, but it's not strange at all. It's what Judaism and Christianity does. You weave the Bible into the religious culture that comes after it.
Right. Well, yeah, because if you do follow exactly what the Bible says, you'll be throwing stones at adulterers. You know, it's not.
Right.
You can't do it. You can't do it. You have to evolve the meaning.
Let's take a few more questions. There are books on sale at the bookstore. And I'm sure, did anyone here bring books to get signed? No? One.
Thank you.
Or Kindles to get signed. So a few more questions. Any students? Lifelong students?
Class of 79. When you were researching the biblical prohibitions, I wonder, did you get any exposure to potentially modern-day explanations for why they may have made sense out of the context from which they came? For example, I'm thinking, don't eat pork, well, trichinosis, if it isn't well-cooked, and cooking technology wasn't very good.
Right.
And so if you don't eat pork, you're not going to cook it badly, and you're not going to get trichinosis. So did you get into any layering like that?
And I definitely
talked. What sort of insights did you glean?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the archaeology actually and science do not back up the trichinosis theory, which is I thought was interesting because it would seem to make sense, but that was more about separating the Hebrews from the Philistines from the pagans, because the pagans ate pork, we're not going to eat pork, and it's God thinks it's an abomination, so a lot of it is about tribalism, separating your own tribe, but it is interesting, trying to figure out. There are a lot of people who try to figure out why would God ban mixed fibers, and there are all these theories, that it's more flammable. So I saw that Cain was a herder, and Cain was a cattle herder.
A shepherd.
Oh, yeah. So, right. So it was shepherd and farmer. That's what it was. Nice. Shepherd and farmer. So you don't want to mix wool and linen. But it was... But in the end, I think that a lot of these things are inexplicable, that we don't have the knowledge. I mean, there was a reason at the time, but we just don't know what it is. And what I found so interesting is some of the really religious Jews say that is the beauty of it, is that we, if you follow the rule like thou shalt not kill or love your neighbor, that's good because that makes sense, you know, that's fine. But if you follow the crazy ones that make no sense, that really shows your faith. So it's almost better to follow these crazy ones. So I thought that was an interesting point of view. They're called Hukim is the official name.
You mentioned before some of the crazy laws that we have in secular society. So you want to tell them some of them?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I was saying that in the beginning I was very skeptical of all rituals because they seem... I was very skeptical of religious rituals because they seem so crazy. But one of my advisors made the point that, you know, it's not... all rituals are crazy, even secular rituals. So if a Martian came down and looked at one community that was not wearing clothes made of mixed fiber, and then looking at another community where you put fire on top of a sweet cake every year and then blow it out, like that, neither of those is rational. They wouldn't say, oh yeah, that one makes sense, but that one doesn't. I became much more pro-ritual. I think the rituals can be beautiful as long as they're not, you know, as long as they're life-affirming rituals. There's horrible rituals too, but so I became much more open to ritual.
Would bachelor party
I'm too old. I don't have any bachelor parties anymore.
Other questions? Well, let's thank AJ for coming. And
thank you, guys.
And we'll stick around for like 20 minutes and sign books and talk informally.